Facebook documents reveal that elite users aren't bound by the rules. Mark Zuckerberg has publicly said Facebook Incorporated allows its more than 3 billion users to speak on equal footing with the elites of politics, culture, and journalism, and that its standards of behavior apply to everyone, no matter their status or fame. In private, the company has built a system that has exempted high-profile users from some or all of its rules, according to company documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The program, known as CrossCheck or XCheck, was initially intended as a quality control measure for actions taken against high-profile accounts, including celebrities, politicians, and journalists. Today, it shields millions of VIP users from the company's normal enforcement process, the documents show. Some users are whitelisted, rendered immune from enforcement actions, while others are allowed to post rule-violating material pending Facebook employee reviews that often never come. At times, the documents show, XCheck has protected public figures whose posts contain harassment or incitement to violence, violations that would typically lead to sanctions for regular users. In 2019, it allowed international soccer star Neymar to show nude photos of a woman, who had accused him of rape, to tens of millions of his fans before the content was removed by Facebook. Whitelist accounts shared inflammatory claims that Facebook's fact-checkers deemed false, including that vaccines are deadly, that Hillary Clinton had covered up pedophile rings, and that then-President Donald Trump had called all refugees seeking asylum animals, according to the documents. A 2019 internal review of Facebook's whitelisting practices, marked attorney-client privileged, found favoritism to those users to be both widespread and not publicly defensible. "We are not actually doing what we say we do publicly," said the confidential review. It called the company's actions a breach of trust and added, "Unlike the rest of our community, these people can violate our standards without any consequences." A program known as XCheck has given millions of celebrities, politicians, and other high-profile users special treatment, a privilege many abuse. Despite attempts to rein it in, XCheck grew to include at least 5.8 million users in 2020, documents show. In its struggle to accurately moderate a torrent of content and avoid negative attention, Facebook created invisible elite tiers within the social network. In describing the system, Facebook has misled the public and its own oversight board, a body that Facebook created to ensure the accountability of the company's enforcement systems. In June, Facebook told the oversight board in writing that its system for high-profile users was used in a small number of decisions. In a written statement, Facebook spokesman Andy Stone said criticism of XCheck was fair, but added that the system was designed for an important reason, to create an additional step so we can accurately enforce policies on content that could require more understanding. He said Facebook has been accurate in its communications to the board, and that the company is continuing to work to phase out the practice of whitelisting. "A lot of this internal material is outdated information stitched together to create a narrative that glosses over the most important point. Facebook itself identified the issues with CrossCheck and has been working to address them," he said. Facebook says its rules apply to all. However, company documents reveal a secret elite that's exempt. Facebook documents reveal that elite users aren't bound by the rules. Mark Zuckerberg has publicly said Facebook Incorporated allows its more than 3 billion users to speak on equal footing with the elites of politics, culture, and journalism, and that its standards of behavior apply to everyone, no matter their status or fame. In private, the company has built a system that has exempted high-profile users from some or all of its rules, according to company documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The program, known as CrossCheck or XCheck, was initially intended as a quality control measure for actions taken against high-profile accounts, including celebrities, politicians, and journalists. Today, it shields millions of VIP users from the company's normal enforcement process, the documents show. Some users are whitelisted, rendered immune from enforcement actions, while others are allowed to post rule-violating material pending Facebook employee reviews that often never come. At times, the documents show XCheck has protected public figures whose posts contain harassment or incitement to violence, violations that would typically lead to sanctions for regular users. In 2019, it allowed international soccer star Neymar to show nude photos of a woman who had accused him of rape to tens of millions of his fans before the content was removed by Facebook. Whitelist accounts shared inflammatory claims that Facebook's fact-checkers deemed false, including that vaccines are deadly, that Hillary Clinton had covered up pedophile rings, and that then-President Donald Trump had called all refugees seeking asylum animals, according to the documents. A 2019 internal review of Facebook's whitelisting practices, marked attorney-client privileged, found favoritism to those users to be both widespread and not publicly defensible. "We are not actually doing what we say we do publicly," said the confidential review. It called the company's actions a breach of trust and added, "Unlike the rest of our community, these people can violate our standards without any consequences." A program known as XCheck has given millions of celebrities, politicians, and other high-profile users special treatment, a privilege many abuse. Despite attempts to rein it in, XCheck grew to include at least 5.8 million users in 2020, documents show. In its struggle to accurately moderate a torrent of content and avoid negative attention, Facebook created invisible elite tiers within the social network. In describing the system, Facebook has misled the public and its own oversight board, a body that Facebook created to ensure the accountability of the company's enforcement systems. In June, Facebook told the Oversight Board in writing that its system for high-profile users was used in a small number of decisions. In a written statement, Facebook spokesman Andy Stone said criticism of XCheck was fair, but added that the system was designed for an important reason, to create an additional step so we can accurately enforce policies on content that could require more understanding. He said Facebook has been accurate in its communications to the board, and that the company is continuing to work to phase out the practice of whitelisting. "A lot of this internal material is outdated information stitched together to create a narrative that glosses over the most important point. Facebook itself identified the issues with cross-check and has been working to address them," he said. Facebook says its rules apply to all. However, company documents reveal a secret elite that's exempt.
Facebook whistleblower revealed on 60 Minutes says the company prioritized profit over public good.
The identity of the Facebook whistleblower who released tens of thousands of pages of internal research and documents, leading to a firestorm for the social media company in recent weeks, was revealed on 60 Minutes Sunday night as Francis Haugen. The 37-year-old former Facebook product manager who worked on civic integrity issues at the company says the documents show that Facebook knows its platforms are used to spread hate, violence, and misinformation, and that the company has tried to hide that evidence. "The thing I saw at Facebook over and over again was there were conflicts of interest between what was good for the public and what was good for Facebook, and Facebook over and over again chose to optimize for its own interests, like making more money," Haugen told 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley quoted one internal Facebook FB document as saying, "We have evidence from a variety of sources that hate speech, divisive political speech, and misinformation on Facebook and the family of apps are affecting societies around the world." About a month ago, Haugen filed at least 8 complaints with the Securities and Exchange Commission alleging that the company is hiding research about its shortcomings from investors and the public. She also shared the documents with the Wall Street Journal, which published a multi-part investigation showing that Facebook was aware of problems with its apps, including the negative effects of misinformation and the harm caused, especially to young girls, by Instagram. Haugen, who started at Facebook in 2019 after previously working for other tech giants like Google, and Pinterest, PINS, is set to testify on Tuesday before the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, Product Safety, and Data Security. "I've seen a bunch of social networks, and it was substantially worse at Facebook than anything I've seen before," Haugen said. "At some point in 2021, I realized I'm going to have to do this in a systemic way, that I'm going to have to get out enough documents that no one can question that this is real." Facebook has aggressively pushed back against the reports, calling many of the claims misleading and arguing that its apps do more good than harm. Every day our teams have to balance protecting the ability of billions of people to express themselves openly with the need to keep our platform a safe and positive place, Facebook spokesperson Lena Peach said in a statement to CNN Business immediately following the 60 Minutes interview. We continue to make significant improvements to tackle the spread of misinformation and harmful content. To suggest we encourage bad content and do nothing is just not true. Several hours after the interview aired, Peach released a more than 700-word statement laying out what it called missing facts from the segment, and saying the interview used select company materials to tell a misleading story about the research we do to improve our products. A spokesperson for 60 Minutes did not immediately respond to a request for comment from CNN Business on Facebook's claims. On Sunday morning ahead of the 60 Minutes interview, Facebook Vice President of Global Affairs Nick Clegg told CNN's Brian Stelter that there is no perfection on social media as much as in any other walk of life. We do a huge amount of research, we share it with external researchers as much as we can, but do remember there is a world of difference between doing a peer-reviewed exercise in cooperation with other academics and preparing papers internally to provoke and inform internal discussion, Clegg said. Haugen said she believes Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg never set out to make a hateful platform, but he has allowed choices to be made where the side effects of those choices are that hateful and polarizing content gets more distribution and more reach.
Facebook grilled by Senate over company's impact on kids.
A Facebook executive was grilled by senators on Thursday about the impact its apps have on younger users, 2 weeks after an explosive report indicated the company was aware that Facebook-owned Instagram could have a toxic effect on teen girls. The hearing, featuring Facebook's global head of safety, Antigone Davis, is the first of two that the Senate Commerce Committee is holding on how Facebook approaches its younger users. Next week, the committee is expected to receive testimony from a Facebook whistleblower. We now know that Facebook routinely puts profits ahead of kids' online safety. We know it chooses the growth of its products over the well-being of our children, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal said in opening remarks at the hearing. And we now know is indefensibly delinquent in acting to protect them. The question that haunts me, Blumenthal added, is how can we, you parents or anyone, trust Facebook? In a sign of the bipartisan pressure on this issue, Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn echoed Blumenthal in her opening remarks directed at Facebook. We do not trust you with influencing our children, she said. The Wall Street Journal reported earlier this month that researchers at Facebook have been conducting studies for the past 3 years into how Instagram, which it owns, affects its millions of young users. The research shows the platform can damage mental health and body image, especially among teenaged girls. Blumenthal said his office created an Instagram account identifying as a 13-year-old girl. It followed some easily discoverable accounts associated with extreme dieting and eating disorders. Within a day, he said, the Instagram recommendations were exclusively filled with other accounts that promoted self-harm and eating disorders. Davis said those accounts would be in violation of Instagram's policies that crack down on content promoting self-harm. Following the journal report, Instagram said it was looking at new ways to discourage users from focusing on their physical appearance. The company also said that while Instagram can be a place where people have negative experiences, the app also gives a voice to marginalized people and helps friends and family stay connected. What's been lost in this report is that in fact with this research, we found that more teen girls actually find Instagram helpful. Teen girls who are suffering from these issues find Instagram helpful than not, Davis said Thursday. Now that doesn't mean that the ones that aren't important to us. In fact, that's why we do this research. Davis, who identified herself as a mother and former teacher, also pushed back on the idea that the report was a bombshell and did not commit to releasing a full research report, noting potential privacy considerations. She said Facebook is looking for ways to release more research. The report, and the renewed pressure from lawmakers in its aftermath, also appeared to force Instagram to rethink its plans to introduce a version of its service for kids under 13. Days before the hearing this week, Instagram said it would press pause on the project. While we stand by the need to develop this experience, we've decided to pause this project, Adam Mosseri, head of Instagram, wrote in a blog post published Monday. This will give us time to work with parents, experts, policymakers, and regulators to listen to their concerns and to demonstrate the value and importance of this project for younger teens online today. In the blog post Monday, Mosseri acknowledged that the journal's reporting has raised a lot of questions for people. Those questions may only persist after the hearing. For 2.5 hours, Ms. Davis offered evasions and misdirections, but refused to commit to a single substantive change or even greater transparency, Josh Golan, executive director at Fairplay, a child advocacy group formerly known as the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, said in a statement Thursday. She also continued to push the fiction that Facebook's interest in Instagram Kids is driven by concern for children's safety when the company's own leaked documents make clear it's part of a larger strategy for growth and to compete with TikTok and Snap for young users.
Facebook is hitting the brakes on Instagram for Kids.
Instagram is pressing pause on plans to develop a version of its service for kids under 13 after facing pressure from lawmakers to back down on the effort and new questions about the impact the photo-sharing service has on teen girls. While we stand by the need to develop this experience, we've decided to pause this project, Adam Mosseri, head of Instagram, wrote in a blog post published Monday. This will give us time to work with parents, experts, policymakers, and regulators to listen to their concerns and to demonstrate the value and importance of this project for younger teens online today. The move comes just days before the U.S. Senate was set to hold a hearing entitled Protecting Kids Online, Facebook, Instagram, and Mental Health Harms to discuss the pressure today's youth face on social media. That hearing comes after a Wall Street Journal investigation around what Facebook knows about how Instagram affects teen users, including their mental health. In the blog post Monday, Mosseri acknowledged that the journal's reporting has raised a lot of questions for people. In a statement earlier this month, an Instagram official noted that while Instagram can be a place where people have negative experiences, the app also gives a voice to marginalized people and helps friends and family stay connected. This is a watershed moment for the growing tech accountability movement and a great day for anyone who believes that children's well-being should come before big tech's profits, Josh Golan, executive director at Fairplay, a child advocacy group formerly known as the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, said in a statement Monday. We urge Facebook to use this pause to actually engage with the independent child development experts who understand how Instagram will undermine young children's well-being, Golan added. We won't stop pressuring Facebook until they permanently pull the plug. In March, BuzzFeed News obtained an internal Instagram memo stating the company had identified youth work as a priority and was planning to build a version specifically intended for kids. In May, 44 attorneys general signed a letter addressed to Facebook FB CEO Mark Zuckerberg, urging him to scrap plans for an Instagram intended for younger users, citing mental health and privacy concerns. The letter came less than a month after child safety groups and members of Congress expressed similar concerns. In a July blog post, the company said it is developing a new Instagram experience for tweens managed by parents and guardians as part of its efforts to reduce the incentive for people under the age of 13 to lie about their age. The reality is that they're already online, and with no foolproof way to stop people from misrepresenting their age, we want to build experiences designed specifically for them, managed by parents and guardians, the post said. During an interview on the Today Show on Monday, Mosseri said Instagram is working on a series of tools to help address mental health. That includes a feature called Take a Break that allows users to temporarily leave the platform when going through a hard time, such as a breakup, without others being able to comment or send messages. Instagram is also working to add optional parental controls to accounts for users 13 and older. The blog post said more details on how this will work will be announced in the months ahead.
Facebook is weaker than we knew.
One possible way to read the Facebook files, the Wall Street Journal's excellent series of reports based on leaked internal Facebook research, is as a story about an unstoppable juggernaut bulldozing society on its way to the bank. The series has exposed damning evidence that Facebook has a two-tier justice system, that it knew Instagram was worsening body image issues among girls, and that it had a bigger vaccine misinformation problem than it let on, among other issues. And it would be easy enough to come away thinking that Facebook is terrifyingly powerful and can be brought to heel only with aggressive government intervention. But there's another way to read the series, and it's the interpretation that has reverberated louder inside my brain as each new installment has landed. Which is, Facebook is in trouble. Not financial trouble, or legal trouble, or even senators yelling at Mark Zuckerberg trouble. What I'm talking about is a kind of slow, steady decline that anyone who has ever seen a dying company up close can recognize. It's a cloud of existential dread that hangs over an organization whose best days are behind it, influencing every managerial priority and product decision and leading to increasingly desperate attempts to find a way out. This kind of decline is not necessarily visible from the outside, but insiders see 100 small, disquieting signs of it every day. User-hostile growth hacks, frenetic pivots, executive paranoia, the gradual attrition of talented colleagues.
Facebook is weaker than we knew.
One possible way to read the Facebook files, the Wall Street Journal's excellent series of reports based on leaked internal Facebook research, is as a story about an unstoppable juggernaut bulldozing society on its way to the bank. The series has exposed damning evidence that Facebook has a two-tier justice system, that it knew Instagram was worsening body image issues among girls, and that it had a bigger vaccine misinformation problem than it let on, among other issues. And it would be easy enough to come away thinking that Facebook is terrifyingly powerful and can be brought to heel only with aggressive government intervention. But there's another way to read the series, and it's the interpretation that has reverberated louder inside my brain as each new installment has landed. Which is, Facebook is in trouble. Not financial trouble, or legal trouble, or even senators yelling at Mark Zuckerberg trouble. What I'm talking about is a kind of slow, steady decline that anyone who has ever seen a dying company up close can recognize. It's a cloud of existential dread that hangs over an organization whose best days are behind it, influencing every managerial priority and product decision and leading to increasingly desperate attempts to find a way out. This kind of decline is not necessarily visible from the outside, but insiders see 100 small, disquieting signs of it every day. User-hostile growth hacks, frenetic pivots, executive paranoia, the gradual attrition of talented colleagues. It has become fashionable among Facebook critics to emphasize the company's size and dominance while bashing its missteps. In a Senate hearing on Thursday, lawmakers grilled Antigone Davis, Facebook's global head of safety, with questions about the company's addictive product design and the influence it has over its billions of users. Many of the questions to Ms. Davis were hostile, but as with most big tech hearings, there was an odd sort of deference in the air as if the lawmakers were asking, "Hey, Godzilla, would you please stop stomping on Tokyo?" But if these leaked documents proved anything, it is how un-Godzilla-like Facebook feels. Internally, the company worries that it is losing power and influence, not gaining it, and its own research shows that many of its products aren't thriving organically. Instead, it is going to increasingly extreme lengths to improve its toxic image and to stop users from abandoning its apps in favor of more compelling alternatives. You can see this vulnerability on display in an installment of the journal's series that landed last week. The article, which cited internal Facebook research, revealed that the company has been strategizing about how to market itself to children, referring to preteens as a valuable but untapped audience. The article contained plenty of fodder for outrage, including a presentation in which Facebook researchers asked if there was a way to leverage playdates to drive word-of-hand growth among kids. It's a crazy-sounding question, but it's also revealing. Would a confident, thriving social media app need to leverage playdates, or concoct elaborate growth strategies aimed at 10-year-olds? If Facebook is so unstoppable, would it really be promoting itself to tweens as, and please read this in the voice of the Steve Buscemi "How do you do, fellow kids?" meme, a life coach for adulting? The truth is that Facebook's thirst for young users is less about dominating a new market and more about staving off irrelevance. Facebook use among teenagers in the United States has been declining for years, and is expected to plummet even further soon. Internal researchers predicted that daily use would decline 45% by 2023. The researchers also revealed that Instagram, whose growth offset declining interest in Facebook's core app for years, is losing market share to faster-growing rivals like TikTok, and younger users aren't posting as much content as they used to. "Facebook is for old people" was the brutal verdict delivered by one 11-year-old boy to the company's researchers, according to the internal documents. A good way to think about Facebook's problems is that they come in two primary flavors: problems caused by having too many users, and problems caused by having too few of the kinds of users at once. Culture-creating, trend-setting, advertiser-coveted young Americans. The Facebook files contains evidence of both types. One installment, for example, looked at the company's botched attempts to stop criminal activity and human rights abuses in the developing world, an issue exacerbated by Facebook's habit of expanding into countries where it has few employees and little local expertise. But that kind of problem can be fixed, or at least improved, with enough resources and focus. The second type of problem, when tastemakers abandon your platforms en masse, is the one that kills you. And it appears to be the one that Facebook executives are most worried about. Take the third article in the journal series, which revealed how Facebook's 2018 decision to change its news feed algorithm to emphasize meaningful social interactions instead generated a spike in outrage and anger. The algorithm change was portrayed at the time as a noble push for healthier conversations, but internal reports revealed that it was an attempt to reverse a years-long decline in user engagement. Likes, shares, and comments on the platform were falling, as was a metric called original broadcasts. Executives tried to reverse the decline by rejiggering the news feed algorithm to promote content that garnered a lot of comments and reactions, which turned out to mean, roughly, content that makes people very angry. "Protecting our community is more important than maximizing our profits," said Joe Osborne, a Facebook spokesman. "To say we turn a blind eye to feedback ignores these investments, including the 40,000 people working on safety and security at Facebook and our investment of $13 billion since 2016. It's far too early to declare Facebook dead." The company's stock price has risen nearly 30% in the past year, lifted by strong advertising revenue and a spike in use of some products during the pandemic. Facebook is still growing in countries outside the United States and could succeed there even if it stumbles domestically. And the company has invested heavily in newer initiatives, like augmented and virtual reality products, that could turn the tide if they're successful. But Facebook's research tells a clear story, and it's not a happy one. Its younger users are flocking to Snapchat and TikTok, and its older users are posting anti-vaccine memes and arguing about politics. Some Facebook products are actively shrinking, while others are merely making their users angry or self-conscious. Facebook's declining relevance with young people shouldn't necessarily make its critics optimistic. History teaches us that social networks rarely age gracefully, and that tech companies can do a lot of damage on the way down. I'm thinking of MySpace, which grew increasingly seedy and spam-filled as it became a ghost town, and ended up selling off user data to advertising firms. But you could find similarly ignoble stories from the annals of most failed apps. Facebook's next few years could be uglier than its last few, especially if it decides to scale back its internal research and integrity efforts in the wake of the leaks. None of this is to say that Facebook isn't powerful, that it shouldn't be regulated, or that its actions don't deserve scrutiny. It can simultaneously be true that Facebook is in decline and that it is still one of the most influential companies in history, with the ability to shape politics and culture all over the globe. But we shouldn't mistake defensiveness for healthy paranoia, or confuse a platform's desperate flailing for a show of strength. Godzilla eventually died, and as the Facebook files make clear, so will Facebook.
Facebook whistleblower, I don't know if you guys watched this last night on 60 Minutes, but he's now accusing the social media giant of misleading the public and the company's investors. Former product manager Frances Haugen saying that Facebook placing profit over safety when it comes to its products, and she spoke out on 60 Minutes in what was, I thought, a pretty riveting interview.
And one of the consequences of how Facebook is picking out that content today is that it is optimizing for content that gets engagement or reaction. But its own research is showing that content that is hateful, that is divisive, that is polarizing, it's easier to inspire people to anger than it is to other emotions. Has realized that if they change the algorithm to be safer, people will spend less time on the site, they'll click on less ads, they'll make less money.
And she took a trove of data, partially appears to have leaked that to the press, but also sent it to the whistleblower's office to the SEC, suggesting that the company was effectively defrauding investors by saying one thing to the public and another thing internally. In a statement, Facebook saying in part, quote, we continue to make significant improvements to tackle the spread of misinformation and harmful content. To suggest we encourage bad content and do nothing is just not true.
Facebook VP brags about censorship, claims hate speech dropped 50% on platform.
Facebook has run right back to censorship gaslighting after having taken a metaphorical beating in the liberal press and from the Hill in recent weeks. The platform has let the world know that it has cracked down on so-called hate speech with extreme prejudice. Facebook released a devastating report about censorship on its platform, a bad omen for those who care about freedom of speech. Our technology is having a big impact on reducing how much hate speech people see on Facebook, Facebook VP of Integrity Guy Rosen explained in an October 17th report. According to our latest Community Standards Enforcement report, its prevalence is about 0.05% of content viewed, or about 5 views per every 10,000, down by almost 50% in the last three quarters. Facebook explained how far its technology has come. In 2016, our content moderation efforts relied mainly on user reports. So we built technology to proactively identify violating content before people report it. The report on hate speech removal appears to have been a tactical move against recent scandals. Data pulled from leaked documents is being used to create a narrative that the technology we use to fight hate speech is inadequate and that we deliberately misrepresent our progress, Rosen noted. This is not true. We don't want to see hate on our platform, nor do our users or advertisers, and we are transparent about our work to remove it. Facebook made the audacious claim that somehow its staff are hesitant at times to remove content. We have a high threshold for automatically removing content. If we didn't, we'd risk making more mistakes on content that looks like hate speech but isn't, arming the very people we're trying to protect, such as those describing experiences with hate speech or condemning it. Facebook's history with content moderation is problematic at best. The platform has allowed its leftist-funded international fact-checking network-appointed fact-checkers to penalize conservative content that is demonstrably true. For example, PolitiFact came after the Media Research Center, MRC, for citing a graphic first released by the CDC. PolitiFact tried to combine three fact-check categories into one. It failed to note its issue as one of context and chose to instead label the entire graphic as false, but called it partly false information on Facebook. Facebook has leaned on hapless sources such as the World Health Organization, WHO. WHO was too reliant on Chinese authorities and misinformed nations around the globe as to the nature of the virus as late as January 14. WHO claimed in a tweet,
"Preliminary investigations conducted by the Chinese authorities have found no clear evidence of human-to-human transmission of the novel coronavirus, 2019-nCoV, identified in Wuhan, China. Facebook, it's a trap.
Facebook has a clear mission, connect everyone in the world. Clarity is good, but in Facebook's case, it has also put the company in a bind because the mission, and the company's vision for creating value through network effects, has also become the source of its biggest problems. As the company moved from connecting existing friends online to making new global connections, both examples of direct network effects, and now to connecting users to professional creators, indirect network effects, it has come under fire for everything from violating individual privacy to bullying small companies as a monopoly to radicalizing its users. Now, it is struggling to find solutions that don't undercut its mission. The author calls this the Facebook trap. To address the problems created by the platform, and by other social networks, too, it helps to clearly establish where the company should be held accountable. While it's reasonable to push for changes in how Facebook's recommendations work, it's harder to decide how the platform should deal with organic connections, which would likely entail censoring users and blocking them from making connections that they want to make. Facebook isn't the only company facing the conundrum of needing to undermine its own mission to minimize harm, and companies and governments will need to develop strategies for how to deal with this issue.
The inevitable evolution of Facebook.
Following its core purpose means Facebook must continue to connect people and to connect them in more intense ways. It can grow the user base and connect more people who otherwise wouldn't have been connected, and it can get the existing user base to connect more intensely by using Facebook more, i.e., by increasing engagement. Both these things directly drive advertising revenue, the predominant mode by which Facebook captures value, i.e., monetizes the user base that otherwise uses Facebook for free, something I have written about with a co-author. The issue is that even if Facebook were only motivated to create value for users through connecting people, without any incentive to capture value through advertising, it would still be on the road to disaster. The difficulties it faces are a fundamental consequence of connecting people. To understand why, let's consider how Facebook has changed since its idyllic early days.
Old friends.
Initially, Facebook connected users to their real-life extended social circle, their local connections. As a millennial, I joined Facebook in high school as an extension of the friendships I already had. In this world, Facebook facilitated direct network effects, or reciprocal content generation between parties. I create content for my friends and my friends create content for me. I would post some prom photos, my friends would post slightly different prom photos, and we would all comment on how great everyone looked. Even if someone looked bad in a photo, no one would ever write that. We still had to see each other in real life. This version of Facebook had some major limitations. First, it didn't really give me access to anything I didn't already have in my life. When I became interested in DJing, a niche interest, I couldn't connect with other DJs on Facebook because I didn't have any in my immediate network of real-life friends. Second, there was a finite amount of content. There are only so many prom photos. Third, regular users don't have the resources to generate high-quality content. No one was professionally airbrushing all these prom photos. In this world, the connections were relatively weak, in the sense that they do not optimize for intense and ongoing engagement that keep me using Facebook.
New friends.
Facebook solved this problem by bringing on millions, and eventually billions, of users and then facilitating global connections. Suddenly, through the stronger network effects of a larger user base, users with niche interests could connect and reach a critical mass. There are plenty of other DJs on Facebook and Instagram for me to connect with. These global connections aren't always good, however. Users with dangerous interests, to oneself and to others, can easily connect with one another and reinforce those interests. A user with suicidal thoughts may now seek advice from others with the same thoughts. A user with racist views can choose to be surrounded by other racists. And once connected, these users gather together at a critical mass and can coordinate activities. This can range from the relatively benign but still damaging, such as multi-level marketing schemes, to the coordination of events such as the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, which was organized across many social networks, but was stoked by online communities of users drawn to conspiracy theories about election fraud.
No friends.
There's another important shift that's happened, too. As Facebook has evolved, it has begun to rely heavily on indirect network effects. Instead of peers reciprocally generating content for one another, a large user base of content consumers incentivizes the professional content producers to keep pushing out content, and the professional content keeps the large user base on Facebook and engaged. Relying on professional content producers to drive indirect network effects has a number of damaging consequences. First, it encourages elite individuals, celebrities or quasi-professional influencers, to portray an unachievable body image and lifestyle as otherwise normal, which Facebook's own research finds can exacerbate depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts in young people. Second, it professionalizes the generation of clickbait. Both traditional media businesses and all-out bad actors have the incentive to pump out content and headlines that exploit the curiosity and emotional reaction of users. Third, it empowers professional extremists to spread explicitly dangerous messages at scale. ISIS has used Facebook effectively for its recruiting efforts by sharing videos of grotesque violence that resonate with disaffected youth. The challenge for Facebook, and for us as a society, is that everything Facebook can do to solve its problem works directly against how it creates value and its core mission. In essence, critics of Facebook are asking it to connect less people and connect them less intensely. But that violates the core ethos of what Facebook has always set out to do. This is the Facebook trap. Depending on who you ask, Facebook's biggest problem might be almost anything. Critics have argued that it's violating individual privacy or bullying small companies as a monopoly, damaging teens' mental health or inciting violent insurrections. The list of possibilities goes on and on. But varied as these troubles may seem, they are actually all facets of one big, fundamental problem that is staring all of us, policymakers, general public, and Facebook's own employees, right in the face. Facebook exists to connect every person in the world, as CEO Mark Zuckerberg himself will clearly and frequently pronounce. At face value, there is nothing wrong with that goal. In fact, it is exactly the kind of strategic clarity that strategy professors would like to see from more companies. As the guiding vision of Facebook leadership, this aspirational ideal has been deeply ingrained into Facebook's company culture. Importantly, connecting people is the fundamental basis on which Facebook has been so successful over the last 15 years. In my course on technology strategy, we teach students that the most important driver of value creation today is network effects. My own value from using Facebook and Instagram Messenger and WhatsApp grows as other users adopt and use Facebook. By following through on its mission to connect people, Facebook facilitates a huge amount of network effects that have propelled its organic growth and reinforces its dominant position in social networking. But as we are all experiencing today, that core purpose leads to myriad negative impacts on all parts of our society. That mission of connecting people is also destroying people's lives and threatening our established institutions. Facebook faces a monumental challenge, because fixing these issues isn't as simple as adding more moderators to watch for hate speech or changing the news feed. It will require a fundamental shift in the company's core strategic goal. In that sense, Facebook is trapped. Network effects made the company a success and now they're threatening to unmake it, but the company can't just turn off the engine that makes it work. So, what can it do?
8 things to take away from the Facebook papers.
For months, Facebook has been shaken by a steady leak of documents from whistleblower Frances Haugen, beginning in the Wall Street Journal but spreading to government officials and nearly any outlet with an interest in the company. Now, those documents are going much more public, giving us the most sweeping look at the operations of Facebook anyone not directly involved with the company has ever had. The documents stem from disclosures made to the SEC and provided to Congress by Haugen in redacted form. The Verge and a consortium of other news organizations have obtained redacted versions of the documents, which we're calling the Facebook Papers. In order to receive the documents, we agreed to begin publishing our reporting on them this week, but we are not beholden to report on them in a certain way or coordinate what we cover with other outlets. We've already done some reporting on the files, and we'll keep reporting on them over the coming weeks. There are a lot of pages. This isn't a comprehensive list of everything in the documents, and you should fully expect more to come out. Instead, think of it as a summary of the files that, so far, have stood out to us the most. Hopefully, it will help you make sense of the sheer volume of Facebook news coming out this morning.
Facebook was caught off guard by vaccine misinformation and comments.
Facebook has taken a lot of criticism for its handling of COVID misinformation, including from President Biden, who accused the platform of killing people by letting anti-vax sentiment run amok, but the leaks show just how chaotic the effort was inside the company. One document dated March 2021 shows an employee raising the alarm about how unprepared the platform was. Vaccine hesitancy in comments is rampant, the memo reads. Our ability to detect vaccine hesitant comments is bad in English, and basically non-existent elsewhere. We need policy guidelines specifically aimed at vaccine hesitancy in comments. Comments are a significant portion of misinfo on FB, says another employee in an internal comment, and are almost a complete blind spot for us in terms of enforcement and transparency right now. The document makes clear that Facebook already had a COVID-19 lockdown defense project dedicated to the platform dynamics created by the pandemic, including a workstream dedicated entirely to vaccine hesitancy. That team had also created significant automated flagging systems for misinformation, but according to the files, those simply weren't being used to downrank anti-vaccine comments. As of the March memo, there were no plans to develop moderation infrastructure like labeling guidelines and classifier systems to identify anti-vaccine statements in comments. The failure to meaningfully moderate comments was noticed outside the company. A first draft news study in May looked at the comments for a handful of major news outlets with more than a million followers and found 1 in 5 comments on vaccine-related stories contained some kind of anti-vaccine misinformation. The documents show Facebook was aware of the problem, and first draft may have even underestimated the issue. One comment on the post reads, "For English posts on vaccines, vaccine hesitancy prevalence among comments is 50%. Other aspects of the issue remained completely unstudied since the company had yet to dig in on the comment problem. We currently don't understand whether group comments are a serious problem, the post argues. It's clear to us that the good post, bad comment problem is a big deal, but it's not necessarily as clear that vaccine hesitant comments on vaccine hesitant posts are additive to the harm." Another document published shortly after April 2021 shows the company still coming to terms with vaccine misinformation. The good news was that there was no evidence of a foreign influence campaign driving anti-vax sentiment, as had stung the company in 2016. But the vast majority of content was being sent by a relatively small portion of accounts, suggesting that Facebook had not yet taken the easiest measures to address the issue. Facebook has taken some steps recently to address misinformation in comments, including new downranking rules from just last week. But these documents show those changes came more than 6 months after the alarm had been raised internally and after Facebook had publicly expressed anxiety about the impending leak. Given the huge surge of COVID deaths among vaccine skeptical populations over the past 3 months, it's easy to see the recent changes as too little, too late.
Apple threatened to ban Facebook over online slave markets.
Facebook scrambled to address human trafficking content after Apple threatened to kick its apps off the iOS App Store, a leaked Sev or Site Event report shows. The report, referenced briefly by the Wall Street Journal's Facebook Files reporting, indicates that Apple threatened to pull Facebook and Instagram from iOS on October 23, 2019. Apple had been tipped off by a BBC News Arabic report that found domestic workers being sold via Instagram and other apps, where sellers encouraged buyers to mistreat the workers by doing things such as confiscating their passports. Facebook had been aware of the problem but hadn't understood the scope of it, apparently because very little content, less than 2% of the material it found, had been reported by users. "Removing our applications from Apple platforms would have had potentially severe consequences to the business," the Facebook report notes. After Apple escalated the issue, Facebook moderators swept the platforms for keywords and hashtags mentioned in the BBC reporting, ultimately disabling 1,021 accounts and removing 129,121 pieces of content. Facebook also removed a policy exception letting established brick-and-mortar businesses like recruitment agencies post ads about domestic workers. Facebook determined that even if the businesses were legal, the policy was highly likely leading to exploitation of domestic servants. Apple was apparently satisfied with the mitigation measures, and the incident was closed within a week.
The civic integrity team was often directly blocked by Zuckerberg.
One of the most alarming incidents uncovered by the papers was that Mark Zuckerberg personally intervened to ensure Facebook would comply with a repressive law instituted in Vietnam, agreeing to moderate more aggressively against anti-state content on the platform. The anecdote leads the Washington Post report on the papers and plays into a much more troubling dynamic described by Haugen before Congress. Facebook's integrity team had lots of ideas for how to make Facebook less harmful, but they were usually overruled, sometimes by Zuckerberg himself. Bloomberg News explores the issue in more detail, showing how the company often found its own efforts to downrank harmful content overwhelmed by the content's inherent virality. As one employee put it, "I worry that feed is becoming an arms race." Politico highlights another employee quote showing just how demoralized the team had become. "If we really want to change the state of our information ecosystem, we need a revolution, not an evolution of our systems," an employee wrote in October 2019. If you don't have enough good content to boost, it doesn't matter how much you downrank the bad.
Facebook used a German anti-vaccine movement as a test case for more aggressive moderation.
Another document details Facebook's so-called Kerdenken experiment, in which the company's moderators tested out a more aggressive moderation approach on a German conspiracy movement. Facebook's dangerous content team was already developing a new classification, a harmful topic community, and the growing Kerdenken was chosen as an experiment on how the classification would work in practice. As a Facebook employee writes in the document, this could be a good case study to inform how we tackle these problems in the future. Kerdenken has become one of the leading anti-lockdown and anti-vaccination groups in Germany, with similarities to more extreme groups like QAnon. As the Facebook proposal framed it, the Kerdenken movement had potential for violence but wasn't yet linked to extreme enough activity that would justify banning followers from the platform entirely. The documents give few details about how the experiment proceeded, although clearly, some version of the Kerdenken plan was implemented. A later report says results from some initial samples look promising. And judging by the company's public statements, it did result in a meaningful change to moderation policy. In September, Facebook announced a new policy on coordinated social harm, specifically citing Kerdenken as an example of the new approach in action. Unlike many of the other documents, the Kerdenken experiment shows Facebook's moderation system as relatively effective. The company identified the group before it caused significant harm, took action with an eye towards long-term consequences, and was transparent about the policy shift after it took place. But the incident shows how complex the interplay of policy and enforcement can be, with broader policies often rewritten with an eye towards specific groups. And for supporters of Kerdenken, it may be alarming to learn that the rules of the world's largest social platform were rewritten specifically to keep their movement from gaining public support.
Facebook's January 6th response was shaped by glitches and delays.
Facebook discussed developing extreme break glass measures to limit misinformation, calls to violence, another material that could disrupt the 2020 presidential election. But when former President Donald Trump and his supporters tried to stop successor Joe Biden from being declared president on January 6, 2021, Facebook employees complained these measures were implemented too late or stymied by technical and bureaucratic hang-ups. Reports at Politico and the New York Times outline Facebook's struggle to handle users delegitimizing the elections. Internally, critics said Facebook didn't have a sufficient game plan for harmful non-violating narratives that toe the line between misinformation and content Facebook wants to preserve as free speech. And some plans, like a change that would have prevented groups from changing their names to terms like Stop the Steal, apparently got held up by technical problems.
Why likes were never hidden on Facebook and Instagram?
A highly publicized plan from early last year to hide like counts on Instagram never happened because testing the change hurt ad revenue and led to people using the app less. A quiet test of the experience on the Facebook app was also killed after leadership told Zuckerberg that it wasn't a top barrier to sharing nor a top concern for people. A lengthy internal presentation to Zuckerberg about the plan, dubbed Project Daisy, shows that there were concerns among leadership about how the Facebook app would have been perceived if Instagram hid like counts and Facebook did not, which is something employees who were involved in the project have told The Verge. Employees working on Instagram wanted to bill it as a way to depressurize the app for young people, but the team working on the Facebook app wasn't into the idea. If Instagram went through with hiding likes, the presentation details how leadership at Facebook wanted to minimize blowback to the Facebook app for not hiding them and still ensure credit ladders up to the Facebook company. Instead of hiding likes for all users by default as was originally planned, Instagram earlier adopted a half measure by letting people opt into hiding their likes.
Facebook civic groups policy stumbled over a simple design flaw.
In October 2020, Facebook announced that it would stop recommending civic and political groups to users in the U.S. as part of a broader effort to avoid the mistakes of the 2016 election. The policy was made permanent shortly after the January 6th riot. But actually keeping those groups out of Facebook recommendation feeds has been a huge challenge for the company, and an internal document gives us new insight into why. The document shows Facebook employees grappling with a public article, flagged by the PR team, which found 30 separate groups still appearing in recommendation feeds in apparent violation of the policy. Escalated on January 19th, the document says many of the groups named in the report had been labeled as civic groups at one point, but were somehow still being recommended as part of Facebook's Groups You Should Join feature. Leakage has been there since November 2020 at the least, the Facebook document reads. It's not clear which article the document is referring to, but there were a number of reports spotting enforcement failures at the time. The markup found a bunch of groups slipping through that January and again in June. Even now, it's not clear the civic groups policy is being enforced as intended. At the time, most observers focused on the conceptual difficulty. It's a hard philosophical problem to draw a clear line between which groups count as civic, and even harder to scale it across a platform of Facebook's size. But the internal report shows the real problem was much simpler. Facebook's monitoring system, referred to in the report as Laser, had been trained to only look at the past 7 days of content when determining whether a page fell into the civic groups category, which meant pages were constantly filtering in and out as the period viewed by the algorithm changed. In practice, that meant a pro-Trump or pro-Biden group could easily dodge the label by posting a few days' worth of less obviously political content. The report estimates that a full 12% of labeled groups would churn out of the category from day to day. According to the report, 90% of the groups highlighted by the article had been caught by Facebook's existing civic groups classifier, but they'd filtered out as part of the churn. So reducing churn alone could have solved almost all of the problems spotted by the report. There have been lots of stories like this over the past 5 years. Facebook sets a policy that seems measured and responsible, but a cursory test, usually from a journalist, shows banned content is still easily slipping through. From the outside, it's often unclear how much of the problem is incompetence at Facebook and how much is just the inherent difficulty of managing a platform of that size. But in this case, the documents put the blame squarely on Facebook as a company. This was a high-profile policy with huge stakes for the country at large, with obvious delicacy in how it was implemented. A churn rate that high made it inevitable that targeted groups would slip through the cracks, and the company simply didn't notice until reporters called them out.
Subscribe to the podcast.